ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
Global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
We're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming.
Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Humans have been reshaping the environment for far longer than we realise, and sometimes in ways that may take us by surprise. This week on The Science Show, we take a good hard look at ourselves and how our actions might have unintended consequences. Smith here, flying solo while Robin Williams is in the US. He'll be back in a couple of weeks with a suitcase chock full of stories and interviews from the best and brightest. But right here, right now, we will discover why a drop in air pollution, great for human health, may spell bad news for the Great Barrier Reef. We will also hear from the director of Australia's oldest scientific institution where conservation, science, and human responsibility meet, and what matters to young Australians as they stare down the barrel of an uncertain future. But first, a reminder that the environmental impact of humans didn't begin with industry. There's a cave on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, where it appears that early members of our species, Homo sapiens, may have displaced, or even killed, the humans that lived there before them. Professor Adam Brum from Griffith University was part of the team that reconstructed the history of the cave's residents. And I asked him, why does Sulawesi attract archaeologists like him?
Sulawesi, it's a really interesting place. It's the largest island in a region that we refer to as Wallacea, which is a unique biofaunal zone located between the continental regions of Asia to the west and Australia and New Guinea to the east. So the island itself has long been isolated. It's never been connected. There's never been a direct terrestrial land connection to either mainland Asia or Australia. So it's evolved its own unique plant and animal communities. And most importantly, for our understanding of the migrations and early history of ancient humans, it's very important because essentially it represents the gateway to the continent of Australia. If you're an early human dispersing, as we say, or radiating or spreading your range from the continental region of Asia further east on your way to Australia, then you more or less have to, well, we think you have to go through Sulawesi first.
So Sulawesi is important for our understanding of how the first people reached Australia and could represent a stepping stone or maybe a stopover point for their journey. But we weren't the first species of human to explore the world, not by a long shot.
Before our species evolved in Africa around about 300,000 years ago, there were many other species of us that essentially close relatives, in some cases ancestors, who were spread out throughout different parts of the world. And Sulawesi was one of these areas that they somehow got to.
When we think of early humans, we often think of caves. And the limestone formations of South Sulawesi are riddled with them. One of these caves is called Liang Bulu Betue, and it includes a nice big chamber, about 10 metres high and 12 metres wide, which is cooled by breezes coming from deep within the limestone cave system. Someone who's felt those cool breezes is Basran Borhan, an archaeologist and PhD student at Griffith University. In 2013, he and other local archaeologists started sussing out Liang Bulu Betue as a potential dig site. And there were some pretty promising signs that people had been living there for quite some time.
Yeah, there is a rock painting on the wall, a black one and another is a red one. The rock paintings mean this site, it's long been occupation.
What do the paintings show?
Painting is only hand stencil. If we compare with another rock painting in this area, it's between 17,000 to 51,000 years ago. It's old.
So the hand stencils were a good indication that ancient humans had once spent time in this cave. But when? To find out, the archaeological team started digging into the floor of the cave, where they'd hopefully find signs of these humans locked away in layers of sediment. Can you just describe how artefacts, fossils, signs of human occupation get locked in layers and how they build up over time?
Okay, this is the bread and butter of archaeological excavation.
Adam Brum again.
In this particular case, we're dealing with a limestone cave. We think we had a combination of factors leading to the creation of these archaeological deposits at this site. One was presence of a stream that probably flowed from the inside of the cave outside, and then at various times another stream that was probably flowing out on the open plain outside the cave and was responsible for bringing in sediments that then accumulated in the cave. So in some cases, we've got quite thick deposits of sand, essentially river sand, that would have accumulated over time. And then you also had early humans living in the entrance to this cave. So they would walk in and tramp in dirt that would then accumulate on the floor over millimetre by millimetre. So over very long periods of time, the presence of humans there, they had fires, for example, and that contributed ash, which then became a part of the archaeological deposit, animal bones that they would leave lying around, stone tools, all of these things over time contributed to the accumulation of these archaeological layers.
So over the millennia, layers of sediment built up, trapping these bones and tools and ash within. But there were also floods that swept some of those layers away.
At some sites, it can be, in Indonesia in particular, in these limestone caves, it can be incredibly complex and extremely difficult to work out the way that these archaeological layers built up over time, these events that affected them, washed them out, and they led to their reaccumulation. It can be incredibly complicated, and this site is a good example of that as well. It took a long time for us to work out what the heck was going on.
So what I'm hearing is it takes a long time for these things to build up and quite a bit of luck to keep them there.
Yes, and then quite a lot of effort to try to reconstruct the story of how they got there, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that story. So when you dug down into the floor of this cave, what did you find?
Literally when we started digging just below our feet, we find a layer from the first prehistoric farmers to spread into Indonesia. So these were an Austronesian-speaking group who arrived probably from Taiwan or adjacent mainland China area around about 4,000 years ago. They spread out of their homeland and then they colonized and moved into the archipelago of the Philippines and then all the way through Indonesia, including Sulawesi, maybe about 4,000 years ago. So we find the archaeological deposits left by these first people who were really farming the land in Indonesia. Pottery, that, you know, these people introduce ceramic pots, other evidence like for introduced domestic animal species like domesticated pigs had not been on the island prior to that. Chickens were not there either. So we find evidence for these first farming people.
Directly below this layer, which was full of chicken bones and pottery and such, the archaeologists found nothing really.
What we call geogenic sediments. So these are layers that just built up essentially through geological actions at a time when there doesn't seem to have been any occupation within the cave. So this is really deep and really, really hard sediments. I think a lot of prior archaeologists usually would stop digging at that point and think, oh, okay, we've already got to the bottom of the human occupation sequence. There's no further evidence for humans inside this cave at that point, but we kept digging through it.
And it's a good thing they did, because after battling their way through that hard, thick layer, they hit gold. Well, archaeology's version of gold anyway.
We got to what we knew at that time were the sorts of deposits left behind by the first modern humans to reach Sulawesi.
Our species, Homo sapiens.
These are distinctive types of stone tools, very complex types of stone tools these people made. These early modern humans, we also see evidence for their artistic behaviour. We find pieces of ironstone hematite or ochre, this iron-rich natural earth pigment that these early people were used for creating cave art as well as body paint.
They kept finding this evidence of early Homo sapiens living in the cave down to layers that were about 40,000 years old. But then, in the older layers of sediment below them,
the nature of the archaeological remains left behind was completely different. There, we didn't find any of these complex modern human-like stone tools. We didn't find any evidence for ochre production, okay, the use of these natural earth pigments. It just was totally different. We found these much simpler, more rudimentary types of stone tools that tended to be larger in size and were less complicated in terms of the way they were made.
Alongside these simpler tools, the archaeologists also found animal remains. Here's Basran Borhan again, the local archaeologist.
Megafauna like a stegodon and dwarf buffalo.
What's a stegodon?
It's like an ancient elephant.
The remains of these long extinct animals like the elephant-like stegodon and dwarf buffalo, plus the haul of relatively simple tools, pointed to the presence of people in the cave well before our species showed up.
That's when things started to get pretty interesting, because once you're seeing evidence for this change in the archaeological record, this behavioural shift, if you like, okay, this transition or this abrupt discontinuity in the cultural lifeways of the people inhabiting the site, and once you start to see evidence that those inhabitants were living on the island at the time these extinct types of creatures were still there, yeah, that's when things got pretty compelling. We encountered this deeper deposits, as we call them, back in 2013, in our first year at the site of excavating, and we've been digging as deeply as we can into those early deposits ever since. Now we're down to about 8 meters below the ground, and it just keeps going. We keep finding there's evidence for human occupation, but we're pretty certain it's not by us. This is some other form of early human, which really makes sense now, because at another site on the island, as we published mid last year, we know that we have stone tools dating back to at least 1 million years ago.
Well, just to put that in context, that's the presence of people on Sulawesi hundreds of thousands of years before Homo sapiens even evolved.
We've got some sort of early human on that island for a very long period of time, but we have never known who they were and what happened to them. And this now, Liangbulu Betwe, is this key site, because it could actually give us the first evidence for a site where there was this transition between this earlier population of now extinct humans and us.
Which poses a pretty interesting question. Had that ancient group of humans vacated the cave by the time Homo sapiens rocked up? Or did we do something to drive them away? Or worse?
That's a huge question that we're trying to answer through these excavations at the site.
Yeah, well, before we get to the potential answers to that question, who might that extinct group of humans be?
The most likely usual suspect would be Homo erectus. So this is this early form of human that some scientists think was our direct ancestor. There's this prevailing idea that we evolved from Homo erectus. This was a species that first appeared in Africa around about 2 million years ago. The dating is not amazing. But they were essentially the first types of early humans that you would be pretty comfortable saying, hey, you're not just an ape standing upright.
The face of Homo erectus would have looked pretty different to ours. We can tell from their skulls that they would have had a protruding brow with less forehead and less chin than we do.
But they were the first species that kind of resembled a human when it really comes down to it. They made these fairly complex types of stone tools, and they somehow managed to spread out of Africa and inhabit quite a lot of the Ice Age world. Obviously not to the Americas or Australia, but they got all the way down into Indonesia and left a lot of their fossils behind on the island of Java. Very famous old fossil sites with lots of remains of Homo erectus, the oldest of which probably dates to around about 1.2 million, 1.3 million years ago. So we suspect that it's Homo erectus that first got to the island. But then you have another problem, because when it comes to hundreds of thousands of years later, where you have this early evidence for humans at Liangbulu Betwe,
that lovely breezy limestone cave on Sulawesi,
there's the possibility it could be another type of human known as the Denisovans. These are, once again, an earlier now extinct type of hominin that initially we only knew about because of the extraordinary discovery of ancient DNA within a sliver of finger bone discovered in a cave in Siberia. Genetic analysis revealed the existence of this previously unknown type of early human that are essentially cousins of the Neanderthals, these so-called Denisovans. And subsequent work has now shown that these early humans actually interbred with early members of our species, including the ancestors of Aboriginal Australians, lots of other peoples in this part of the world, which suggests that at some point prior to the colonisation of Australia, at least 65,000 years ago, these distant ancestors of Indigenous Australians came face to face with these still living Denisovan hominins and interacted with them in both culturally and in other ways, left this genetic legacy in the genetic makeup of modern Aboriginal people. So there's one argument that these Denisovans actually got to Sulawesi and that this is where this interbreeding event with modern humans took place.
So it looks like, at least at Liangbulu Betue, Homo sapiens showed up, and whoever was there before, whether that was Denisovans or Homo erectus, disappeared if they hadn't already. But Homo sapiens tends to have a habit of showing up and then other species disappearing. Can you tell me about other places in the world that this has happened?
You don't have to go too far from Sulawesi to find an example of just that, to the island of Flores to the south. We had the famous Homo floresiensis.
You might have heard it nicknamed the Hobbit.
This ancient lineage of these weird, tiny, small-brained humans that lived in this very remote island for at least a million years until we showed up. Well, we don't actually know precisely who those early modern humans were that first arrived on that island around about, at this stage, maybe 47, 50,000 years ago. But we're pretty sure they would have been closely related to the ancestors of the first Australians, probably part of the same broad population. They turned up, whatever it was, 47, 50,000 years ago, and that's the last we ever see of the hobbits. And there's only a single site at this stage that can tell us anything about the nature of this key point in time when modern humans arrived and the hobbits disappeared. So sadly, we don't really know exactly what happened, but it's pretty sure that we just did our thing, that we wiped them out. And we did the same to the Neanderthals, most likely. We probably did the same to the Denisovans. We just, whatever it was, whatever it is about our species, yeah, we don't sort of get along well with others.
So back to this Sulawesi cave, Liangbulu Betue. There is one thing that would really help archaeologists like Adam and Busran to nail exactly who those early inhabitants of the cave were.
When you're in an island like Sulawesi, where there's never been any discovery of an early human fossil, it's frustrating. We know they're there. They have to be there. These early humans were living on that island for a million years. And we talk about that a lot at our base camp, sitting around drinking palm wine and wondering, where the heck are these hominin fossils and how do we find them? I mean, apart from just sheer serendipity and luck, it's just perseverance. You just have to keep digging. You have to keep looking and hope that one day you get lucky.
Busran, are there plans to keep excavating the cave? Do you still work there? And what's next for you?
Next is to dig more to reach the bedrock. So we hope that someday we'll find the hominin in Liangbulu Betue.
So the best might be yet to come, really.
Yeah.
Busran Borhan, an archaeologist and PhD student at Griffith University, along with Professor Adam Brum. You can read their study in the journal PLOS ONE. And it's been a busy couple of months for Adam and Busran. They were part of another study involving a different Sulawesi cave. It contains a hand stencil which they calculated is at least 67,800 years old, making it the oldest known rock art in the world. You can hear all about that study in Lab Notes with Jonathan Webb. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. Now, to another surprising discovery, and one that's closer to home, the Great Barrier Reef. It turns out a policy that reduces shipping pollution, which means cleaner air, has also brought with it a new environmental problem. The reef has already suffered through six mass bleaching events in the past decade alone, but cleaner air may be making them worse. I know, sometimes it feels like we just can't win, but anyway, this seemingly paradoxical effect was uncovered by Dr. Robert Ryan from the University of Melbourne. We had a chat about the study behind the finding and what atmospheric chemistry research involves.
It's the science of all of the molecules in the air, the molecules that we breathe, molecules that come out of plants, come out of industrial sources, how they mix together, how they create air pollution, how they interact with sunlight, and how they give rise to the air that we breathe and see around us.
And you have a special research interest in the Great Barrier Reef. Before we get into that, have you seen much of it?
I have. I'm lucky enough to have spent a bit of time at the Great Barrier Reef on fieldwork for this project. So I got to spend about 7 weeks there on a beautiful little place called One Tree Island, which is near Heron Island, which is more well known as a tourist resort. And I was lucky enough to spend 7 weeks there studying the clouds and the atmospheric chemistry and all of the particles in the atmosphere that go into making up the science of how radiation, sunlight and air interacts with the Great Barrier Reef.
And how do you study the air above us? I can't imagine it's just you lying on a beach looking up into the beautiful blue sky, as idyllic as it sounds.
The instruments that I predominantly use actually do just get to stare up into the beautiful blue sky. I actually specialise in using sunlight to measure components of the atmosphere. So as the sun comes down through the atmosphere, it is absorbed by different gases and particles and scattered by different things, clouds, particles, droplets. And so I use the spectrum of sunlight as it comes down through the atmosphere from the sun to study what's in the atmosphere. But there's a range of other tools as well. We have instruments that have a little pump that suck the air in and measure inside something like a mass spectrometer. But we also use a lot of computer models as well to study the atmosphere. So something like a weather forecasting model, but as well as weather forecasting, it also includes chemistry. So it solves all of the equations for the chemical reactions that are going on as well as for the weather. And so these are the tools that we use for studying different problems about forecasting and predicting air quality and climate. And then we check all of these models against the observations that we take as well.
What's in the atmosphere above the Great Barrier Reef?
The vast majority of what's in the air above the Great Barrier Reef is exactly the same as what's in the air anywhere, and that's nitrogen and oxygen, but there are these trace components that are really super important. So some of these trace components are also everywhere, like carbon dioxide, so the same greenhouse gas concentrations. But there are also air pollutants that come from sources on land in Queensland. There are air pollutants that come from sources like shipping. There are air pollutants or things that could be air pollutants but are also a natural part of the environment that come from plants. There are even some things emitted from the water itself. So these include gases that come from coral and other marine organisms that interact with things in the air as well. Yeah, there's a whole range of different things, millions and millions of compounds that we can't even quantify, but it's a really interesting mixture. And most interestingly for what I'm looking at the Great Barrier Reef are the particles. So the particles are the things that interact with radiation. They can block some of the sunlight coming in, and they also play a really important role in helping to form clouds and change cloud properties. And those particles can come from air pollution like shipping. They can come from within the reef itself. So some of those gases go on to form particles in the atmosphere. And it can also be from things on shore. It could be maybe smoke in Queensland that drifts out over the Great Barrier Reef. And those particles also play a role in blocking sunlight and changing clouds.
Now, you recently had a study which looked specifically at ship pollution. And it had this paradoxical effect of maybe having a benefit for the Great Barrier Reef. We normally think about pollution as being a bad thing. What was that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting paradoxical finding for the study that I've been working on just recently. And it comes back to what I said about aerosols being able to block some of the radiation coming in from the sun. So there has been some pollution from shipping historically that's played what we and other scientists find to be a reasonably significant role in blocking sunlight coming in to the surface of the Earth. So that is both because the particles themselves scatter and block sunlight, and also because the particles go on to help form clouds. And of course, clouds being white are much more reflective than the particles themselves. So aerosol particles, so an aerosol in this case, not just something from a deodorant can, but it's really what scientists term as any kind of particulate matter in the atmosphere. It's kind of like the width of a human hair or slightly smaller than that. These particles in the atmosphere are helping to interact with sunlight. And because they interact with that incoming radiation, the net effect is that they actually cool the surface of the Earth slightly. And so they counteract other warming that's going on in the atmosphere due to greenhouse gas emissions. So the paradoxical finding is that if ship emissions have changed recently to reduce the amount of aerosol, reduce the amount of particulate matter, then that reduction has actually resulted in more sunlight reaching the Great Barrier Reef. So in the year 2020, the International Maritime Organization did make such a change. They said, for the benefit of air pollution, for the benefit of the air that people are breathing, especially people in port cities where there is a lot of ships, they said, we're going to cut a large amount of the aerosol pollution from shipping. So that's a great thing for people's health. That's a really great benefit. But what we've found is that it's allowed more sunlight to come into the Great Barrier Reef, and it's actually had probably a net negative benefit on the Great Barrier Reef, which is already struggling from climate change.
So cleaner air equals hotter corals in some way.
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Rising ocean temperatures are a primary driver of coral bleaching. So how much of an effect does that extra sunlight, that extra radiation have on the ocean and the corals that live in it?
So what we did is we looked at period in the year 2022 using our atmospheric chemistry model, and we were able to simulate a scenario where we included the ship emissions as they used to be and included the emissions in a separate simulation where the emissions have changed. They've reduced according to the International Maritime Organization regulation. And what we found is that the sea surface temperature increase that has likely occurred as a result of that emission change is going to equate somewhere between 10 and 20% worsening of the bleaching conditions if we were to have the same weather conditions now as when the regulation was not in force prior to the year 2020. So we're talking about a 10 to 20% worsening of bleaching severity on top of what is already going on with increasing frequency of marine heat waves and increasing global atmospheric and ocean temperatures.
Is there a way to emulate the sunscreen effects of particulates in the atmosphere without harming human health or putting other nasties in the atmosphere?
We'd definitely love to find a way to do that. But before we even think about that, the first thing that I really want to say is that this is an indicator of how much trouble the Great Barrier Reef is in, because even if we're implementing an air pollution benefit regulation, we are having most likely this negative consequence. And so before going to Band-Aid solutions, we really need to look at the net effect and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, because the rising greenhouse gas emissions, which are causing the rise in global temperatures in the ocean and the atmosphere, are what is primarily driving coral bleaching. The effect that we have found, that extra 10 or 20%, is problematic, but it's paling into insignificance compared to the real challenge facing the Great Barrier Reef. Our finding is a message that we need to be extra urgent about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. However, in the meantime, maybe due to the fact that greenhouse gases are in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, especially carbon dioxide, maybe the fact that policy updates will take a really long time to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, scientists are also looking at potential measures to help mitigate some of the worst effects of climate change, to maybe act a little bit like that sunscreen that you talked about. So one of those possible things is an intervention that's being studied called marine cloud brightening. And this is an area of research where we would look to use a natural component of the atmosphere. In this case, it would be spraying seawater into the air so that the little tiny salt crystals in the seawater can act in a similar way to the ship pollution that was regulated. And it can go on to block some of the sunlight and change the clouds in a way that uses, instead of the air pollution sulfur coming from the ships, instead sea salt that's a natural component of the atmosphere. So that's one thing that's being looked at the moment through the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program, which is underway. And a big part of my research is making sure that if that was to be implemented, that we do all the necessary safety checks and we look at all of the potential downstream impacts and just make sure for certain that that's not going to have the same kind of air pollution impact as the ship emissions that were regulated away.
Yeah, what would some of the downsides be, or some of the downstream effects? I mean, if you're spraying salt into the atmosphere, could that fall as rain on land and I don't know, damage agricultural areas?
That's all of the stuff that we're checking. Yeah, so we want to check that there's no downstream impacts over coastal or land areas from spraying extra salt. We don't believe that the proposed salt emissions are going to outweigh the natural salt emissions in any significant way, but we need to make absolutely sure that that's not going to be the case. We need to make absolutely sure that there'll be no impact on clouds, the air that people breathe, and any other air pollution or atmospheric chemistry effect. We don't believe that that will be the case, but we're doing all the due diligence to make sure.
Does this work mean that you get to spend another 7 weeks on the Great Barrier Reef?
I would, of course, love to spend more time at the Great Barrier Reef. It's just such a beautiful place. Yeah, the corals and the water are so mesmerising. I'm really lucky to be able to go with an atmospheric chemist and to have experienced a world that people in my field of science often don't get to see. So I'd love to go back, of course. Who knows? We'll see. Hopefully the future has another trip out there in store for me.
Dr. Robert Ryan, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Melbourne. His study was published in the journal Communications, Earth and Environment. Now, you may remember last week, Robin spoke to Professor John Durance, director of the Whitlam Institute at Western Sydney University. They discussed an annual Australia-wide competition where students from grade 5 to year 12 write about whatever matters to them. And it's a popular competition. 6,500 young people entered last year. So what can we make of these thousands of entries? Robin didn't have the time to read every single one, so to find out what themes emerged from the essays, he caught up with Professor Philippa Collin, social scientist at Western Sydney University.
Are any of them rather puzzled by the fact that you're asking them to write 600 words? You know, this is not TikTok stuff. Do they protest at having to write all this material?
So the entrants that I've spoken to, no, they don't. I think most of them feel actually really grateful to have a platform on which to explore an idea, to express their views. I think many of them feel quite astounded that anyone really cares and reads it. And certainly most of the finalists seem to be quite surprised and delighted that they've been selected. I think having looked at now nearly 50,000 entries in one way or another, I think there are still a lot of young people who maybe don't take the platform as seriously as they could. But from my point of view, that's a question of habit. We routinely tell young people that their ideas don't matter that much, that they're here to learn and not to do democracy. So, I mean, from my perspective, the competition is a really exciting platform that we should be building on.
And as a judge, do you look at it either as a trained psychologist or a sociologist or what? What kind of ologist are you?
I usually have a few lenses through which I try to assess them, and it's really very, very hard. You know, we're looking for things like how do they express their ideas, the originality of how well documented their ideas are. The wonderful thing about the competition is that they can write a sort of a traditional essay, or sometimes they're more like an opinion piece, but they can also use creative expression. So poetry, a lot of them use like a slam poetry style. So it's actually a very hard competition to judge. What kind of ologist am I? I don't know, maybe a youthologist. I try to just hear what it is that they're saying.
You started off in mental health.
Yes, that's right. So that was the first job that I had out of university, where my role was actually as the youth participation coordinator. So I was a very opinionated young person who felt very strongly that young people's views counted and that we didn't listen to or take them seriously enough. I famously got the job after an interview in which I said I didn't have a mobile phone and I hated the internet.
Did you really? And do you still?
I have a love-hate relationship with both of those things. Yeah, I think that they're important and have their place. But I guess the reason why I probably got that job is because they were looking for someone who was going to really deeply engage with young people and not get carried away with the promises and the prospects of the technology itself. And I still really feel that way. I mean, I see the technology as sociocultural as much as a technical construct, and we can't separate ourselves out as humans and as members of communities and societies from the way that the technology works and the impacts that it has.
Well, one thing that the technology does, it atomizes. In other words, you've got things fractured. You've got bits of this and bits of that, bits of something else, and most of us don't necessarily like most of the tech because we drown in it. But there are some political elements that try to flood the zone. You know, it creates the chaos from which you can do various takeover things. But when you've got all of these, what, 20 years worth of material, and the last 2025, I think you had 6,250 entries. What do you make of all that material? What use is it?
Most of the time we don't take any notice of what young people have to say or think about politics or society because we deem them sort of pre-political, if you like. And so we might use surveys to look at their civic and democratic knowledge. And then we might use interviews or focus groups or something like that to find out what do they think about democracy today and what's the future hold and will our democracy be in peril because this is a generation that doesn't understand or care about it. But when I looked at those entries and after 5 or 6 years, because we started the research actually in 2019, but having been a judge for about 5 years and having read so many of these entries and realised these young people are already expressing the kinds of norms and values and concerns and sort of visions for what their community, what Australian society should look like, what a good society looks like. Right here, we've got a corpus of material that will help us to understand something about this generation's approach, experiences, and maybe tell us something about what we could do better in terms of governing society. So with my colleague Sky Hugman at Western Sydney University, we digitised all of the entries that hadn't been digitised to date. And we had to come up with a methodology for how we would examine them. It was pretty hard, actually, especially if you've seen a 12-year-old's handwriting. It's not the easiest thing to discern. And a lot of the entries in the early days were handwritten. They're all digitized now, which would make it much easier. But basically, we used natural language processing to sort of mine the text, to look for associations, keywords, you know, what were the dominant themes. But also, when young people were writing about mental health or writing about family or writing about animals or the ocean or the environment, what were they actually talking about? And then what we did is we took a small batch analysis approach where we chose 100 entries from each year level in each year to look deeply at what those young people were saying, so used more analogue social science methods. And then we interviewed finalists to get a bit more of an insight into why they wrote about what they wrote about, what they thought about the competition itself, and broader, I guess, questions of what they hope today's adults, policymakers, political leaders and decision makers will or could do differently in light of the sorts of things that they were writing about.
Are they worried?
So having analysed now these two cohorts, if you like, the 2009 to 2019 and then 2019 to 2024, there are a couple of really strong sentiments that come through. One is that young people are really concerned about the future, and that's the near future. That's not like, what will my life be like when I'm a 30-year-old or when I'm older? It's like, what will the life be like next year, in 2 years, in 5 years' time? So there's a lot of concern that comes through in most of the pieces of writing. There's also a really strong ethic of care. So young people in these essays talk about the relationships they have with other people, places and things, and the ways in which we are, in a sense, all bound to look after one another. And that was something that we were really surprised about. Of course, there are essays where young people are talking about individualism and greatness and leaders and calling out much more sort of individualistic or liberal style values and ethics. But for the bulk of the entries, we were really struck by how young people take this much more relational view, how we live together, how we care for one another, what we do together counts. And that's right from the very local through to kind of view around Australia and who we are as Australia's place in the world and then thinking more about sort of global or international relations.
Why are there far more young women than young men?
Some of the things that we have identified in what young people write about could give us some clues. The young women in the competition tended to write about women's issues, issues of justice, equity, peace or peace building. They were much more likely to write about issues such as the environment and to think about those broader questions of sustainability. Young men tended to write more about things like, you know, mateship or friendship. They also wrote about family, but sport, work was also another one that came up. So I think there's a question about how we socialise young people right from a very early age. The interesting thing though is even though young women are more likely to be engaged in this competition, and it's worth saying that a lot of the entrants come from schools that have signed up to take part, and so it may be just that there's a bit of a skew in terms of more gender-specific girls-only schools taking part. But I think young women are probably more likely to grab an opportunity to use a platform when it's there, even though as they get older, there's good research to show that they start to believe and internalise ideas about them not playing a leadership role or not being the kind of person who puts up their hand to take on a leadership position or run for a seat in Parliament, for instance.
Finally, and very briefly, are you surprised by the huge numbers you're getting?
No, I think that all of the research really shows that, and it's important not to generalise about young people, obviously. They're a broad church, in inverted commas. And there are a lot of young people who are more interested in the latest fashions and what their friends are doing than they are in politics. But what we see across the board is that young people are concerned about issues. When they have an opportunity and believe that the people who are asking them questions have a genuine interest in what they have to say and will do something about it, then they are very much motivated to play a role, to have a say, to get involved. The onus is on those of us that they may see as the audience to think about, take seriously and ask ourselves the question, how do we engage with them more and what do we do with what it is that they have to say?
Professor Philippa Collin from Western Sydney University. Entries for this year's writing competition are now open. Just search online for Whitlam Institute What Matters. Looking to the future now, Dr. Simon Duffy has been director of the Royal Botanic Garden Sydney for coming up to 2 years now, and the Botanic Garden itself will celebrate its 210th birthday this year. Robin caught up with Dr. Duffy to find out how he and the Sydney Gardens are helping protect the nation's plants from the ravages of climate change.
Why did you choose to leave the animals and come to the plants?
Look, I think I was compelled to because of the power of plants. I'd been involved in conservation for a long time at Taronga, and I truly understood that everything is connected. Biodiversity is just not one thing. It's all of us, and we're all part of nature. And plants are at the basis of all of that. If you don't have plants, you don't have life. So I was compelled by that, but also who wouldn't want to work at the most beautiful location in the world?
It is beyond belief, isn't it? And I always used to, in the old days, having caught a ferry, walk through the gardens here, and they set me up for the day. It's quite wonderful. And how's it been in a year and a half since you've been here?
It's been truly amazing. I continue to learn so much every day. I continue to be inspired by the hundreds of people that work here and the hundreds of volunteers that also dedicate so much time to this organisation. And I'm also truly inspired by the science and the depth of scientific work that is undertaken every day at Botanic Gardens of Sydney.
Yes, it's vital, isn't it? Because it's not only intellectually stimulating, but it takes you right round the country. It's not just up the road and round the corner, but it's everywhere.
It is. I've been fortunate that in my year and a half since I joined, I've been out seed collecting at the Warren Bungles with our scientists. I've worked in grounds with the horticulturalists and preparing for spring. So yeah, the Botanic Gardens has work all over the state in science, but also in education.
The Warren Bungles, as I remember, one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world, with a fantastic telescope on top.
That's it. That's it. I was out there. It was a very hot day, but we're out there collecting seeds to go to our seed bank, the largest seed bank in Australia. And that seed bank is one insurance program against extinction.
And you've moved it. How did you actually do that?
It was done before I came, but the team, many, many years in planning. And what I was most impressed with, Robin, is the foresight of the future. So, you know, there's many examples when people are building new facilities and you're building a plant bank, and this is millions of seeds that have to be stored here and they're used for science. And then also our herbarium, which is the dead plant collection, which is used for science and education and art and many other things. But when you go to these institutes out at our Australian Botanic Gardens, Mount Annan, I was blown away by its future foresight. It's got room for growth, more seed collection, more herbarium specimens, which will contribute to science. So the team did an amazing job.
I remember a story, I think it was to do with the Nazis invading Russia. There had been part of the area which was a seed bank, and as the local population starved, especially the scientists, the temptation briefly was to cook up the seeds. They may left them untouched and enjoyed the famine as much as they could.
Yeah. I think there's probably a story behind every seed. And when you visit the seed bank or the Australian Herbarium of New South Wales, one of the things that made the hair on the back of my neck stand up was going into the vaults. And these vaults made out of compressed soil, earth, they're beautiful but also very, very important. Specimens are under temperature control. Is Brett Summerall, our chief scientist, the wonderful man and scientist, his party trick is to pull out one of the folders from the store and open it up, and it's one of Sir Joseph Banks' Banksias, and with Sir Joseph Banks' handwriting on the label, and it just gives you goosebumps.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because in the early days, the Europeans, many of them actually going to various parts of Australia in the West. And you can go to Oxford and see some of those seeds that they collected way back, but they've got them here as well. What about the involvement of the citizen scientists, which can be in the field and bring back all sorts of things from slime molds to Wallamai pines?
That's it. There's a huge story, which I know you've told before, about the Wallamai pine and coming across this unusual plant and then bringing it back to the Botanic Gardens and having it identified. We have our scientists working out in the field every day and working with partners and universities, and we do things like buy blitzes and we're out there all the time collecting new information and bringing that back to the organisation with the intention to share it, but also with the intention for the conservation of nature. We're working on things as well like diseases. That's a huge threatening process to our future, and the team here are working on ways we can address some critical, wicked pathogens like Phytophthora and myrtle rust, which is really, really important work.
Phytophthora infestans trying to attack those vineyards I treasure.
Yeah, totally. All of us treasure those. But the team here are working on that. We now have a PCR test similar to what we all went through during COVID to be able to test if a plant in the soil has Phytophthora, and then working on what's the next development of that, how we can wash the soil so that we're not spreading these diseases around Australia, which really, really threatens plants and biodiversity.
Yes, could you sum up really the effect of some of the new sciences and the new technologies, such as looking at genomes, in other words, how you have to do so much more to get the full story of what's going on environmentally and in terms of, well, the different species we have?
Yes. So one of our science labs here at Botanic Gardens is called the Research Centre for Ecosystem Resilience. So this team are amazing and they specialised in genome sequencing plants that can tell you how healthy those plants are from inbreeding or genetic diverse perspective. So they can go into a forest and they can see that maybe through unintentional plantings or through fragmentation of forests, that particular areas are inbred, basically, and they're not going to thrive because they are inbred. So with that sequencing work, they can then say, well, if you want that forest to thrive, go over here to another part of Australia, collect some DNA from there, whether it's in plants or seeds, bring it back, let the natural process happen, and that forest will thrive much better. So they're using that program called Restore and Renew to help provide free advice to regenerators about how to build up these better resilient, because if a forest is thriving, it's more resilient places, but also it does predict impacts of climate change. So it can predict which plants were going to do better in a changing climate, and they can give you advice on what to plant where.
Restore and Renew, yes. Well, the picture I'm getting from a number of places, including here, Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney, the oldest scientific institution with an European origin, 1816, as we've said before, and we'll say it again, it's part of a collaborative work across Australia that includes not just all the different branches of science, but corporations and universities, you name it. There's the potential there is actual breathtaking as long as the support is maintained. Or am I being too romantic?
Not at all. I love it. Our vision is plants at the heart of a thriving world. And we exist to inspire enjoyment. Come and enjoy our beautiful botanic gardens. We exist to inspire learning. But ultimately, we exist for the conservation of nature. So we partner with all of those, as you mentioned, universities, other scientific groups, schools. We partner with all of them with the ultimate goal of conservation of nature.
And your artists are pretty good. You keep having wonderful exhibitions, and I've been to several of them. Finally, what about your own background? What sort of ologist have you been?
Yes, so my background originally was in education. And then I studied further in behavioral psychology around how do you inspire people to make better choices for conservation. And that's been a very big passion of mine, and implemented some things in my previous role, which I was director at Taronga Zoo. And how do you compel people to make better choices in their everyday life for conservation? Because ultimately, we're the ones that have created the problem, and we need the ones to change to be able to fix this problem that we're in. That's been my passion and my background.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Simon Duffy, director of the Royal Botanic Garden in Sydney, and it truly is a lovely place to spend a few hours. Next week, you might have heard the story about elephants being afraid of mice, but what about bees? I find out how scientists in Africa are using this information to keep pesky pachyderms away from crops. The Science Show can be heard in full on Saturdays at noon and Monday at 4 a.m. Our short version is Monday at 1:30 p.m. and Tuesday 9:30 p.m. with the full version and individual stories available online and on ABC Listen. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher, and I'm Belinda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.